And welcome back to Coast, Marshall Masters with us as we talk about Planet X and also Radio Free Earth and take your phone calls as well. Marshall, since you've been doing this with the Planet X situation as well, are you anxious that we discover it?
I never want to live to see it, to be honest.
Really?
I know what it's going to bring. I know what it's going to bring. I know the pain and suffering it's going to cause. And so I'll see it as everyone else does, but I have no personal excitement for seeing it.
But if you're still around and it happens.
If I'm still around and it happens, and I will be doing my work. I will be reporting on it, and I will be in service to people. And my mission is to help people survive what's going to come.
Will you be saying, hey, I told you so?
Not me. Nah, I'm not going to. People are going to be in a terrible state of shock when it happens. And, you know, hearing somebody going, I told you so, even though they've been mocked and ridiculed for a long time, it's not constructive. I'm going to be the one that just will sit down next to you and wait for you to ask a question, and I'll quietly answer it and keep it succinct and short and to the point and help people to get through it. That is what I will be doing.
Good for you. Let's go to the phones. Barry in Rock Hills, South Carolina. Hey, Barry, how are you?
Hey, George, I'm doing great, buddy. I just wanted to mention to Marshall and you too, of course, if the grid goes down, you know, we can't just get online and do things, obviously, because electricity is too important. But I'll never forget, George, it was 1957. I was in the ninth grade, and my granddaddy was a telegraph operator for the Atlantic Coastline Railroad. He came right through Fayetteville, North Carolina. And I used to go down and sit and listen to him with doing the Morse code back and forth to his friends all the way from California to back to North Carolina. And he told me back then, and y'all just reminded me of it, I hadn't thought about it in years, if everybody knew Morse code and had a little setup in their house, which is not expensive at all, we could all communicate with each other even with no grid.
That's absolutely right, Marshall.
I love this guy. I love this guy. He's got it. That's exactly what it's all about. You know, one of the things I do in here is not only about helping kids, but teenagers need to get these little, they're called QRP radios. I mean, they work on very low voltage, but boy, they can send a signal quite a distance, but it's only Morse code. And they could go out and you could have kids there. They could learn it. They're the ones that are going to learn it fast. And then here comes the thing about knowledge exchange is that you're no longer isolated. You can exchange information with people in other communities. They could tell you how they found a way to cure cure disease, how to purify water, some way to, you know, make energy. This information can be shared with Morse code. Remember that scene in the movie Independence Day? And they finally figure out how to blow up the ships, and the guy's going, and they're all sitting there sending out instructions all around the world on how to take them down, and they're using Morse code.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
And that's exactly the same thing. It will be. And the beautiful thing about Morse code is it's English and it's universal. So if you are in a communication with somebody in Europe, you're going to be doing English-based Morse code. Everybody's got to do it that way. And it'll be a phenomenal way to share information. If your community is fractured and you have groups that have to go out in different areas, they're still going to be able to communicate with each other using these really inexpensive little radios that are just designed for Morse code only. And but also, I talk a lot about in survival communities, you're going to have ex-military and police, and they're going to understand you don't wait for the nasties to come into your inner boundary. You don't want them at the wire. You want to go out into the field, and you want to deal with them as far away from the community as possible. And so I devote a lot of work into how to support operational field teams working tens of miles and more away from the community so that they can communicate, keep things going. And the beauty of it is these radios just don't cost that much money, not the ones I talk about.
Do you think that the very wealthy already have bunkers set aside for things like this?
Oh, absolutely. In the lead up to 2012, I did a lot of consulting with wealthy people that were building bunkers. And I'm talking about bare bones entry level was a half a mil. And the work that I did with these folks typically was location analysis. And I will tell you, they're very impressive. They do their homework. Typically, they wouldn't contact me for consulting until they had first money down to go into escrow on whatever property they wanted. And then I would be, they would tell me within 30 miles of where they were located with this, and I would give an assessment of the survivability of the area. And I have a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being ground zero. You're going to die. You're going to die badly. And 10 is as good as it gets. Now, there's no place in the U.S. I give a 10 because of our government.
Right.
But in Canada, there's a couple of spots I give a 10. Interestingly enough, I saw the map from Ed Dames, and I'm going, my gosh, we must be psychic blood brothers because we're both designating the same ideal areas. But one of the things I found with the wealthy was that I have a level 7 and above. Anything that's 7 and above is survivable. And they were consistently 8.5 to 9.5 in that range. And I was really impressed. People who have the money, they don't equivocate. Once they're going to do it, and they're really good at it.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Angel's with us in Sparta, Michigan. Hi, Angel.
Hi, how are you guys?
Okay, we're all right.
All right. My question is, I have been studying the ham, the book, and it's a book that I got from Radio Shack, I stopped. And I know the importance. What do I need to go forward? I stopped.
Why'd you stop?
Now I need to pick it back up, and I don't know where to start.
Why'd you stop?
Life changes.
Uh-huh. How do you pick it up, Marshall? What do you recommend?
Well, I appreciate her. Life is that funny thing that gets in the way of your plans. Here's something that you can do. This is a fast way to get your license. Yeah, you can go to the ARRL.org site. You can find a ham radio group that's in your area and contact them, and they typically are going to do something called a ham cram. And what they do is you can actually download the answers to all the questions that the government gives with the correct answers. And with a ham cram, it takes about 4 hours. Then you go straight into the test, and it's purely a memory implant process. What you're doing is they read the question, and then they only read the correct answer. And as they're reading the correct answer, you highlight that so that you have now auditory, tactile, and visual. So it gets the right question into your mind. You go through the whole block of questions, and then from there you go straight in, you take the test. I did ham crams, and I have a general license. First you get your technician, then you go to your general, then you go to extra if you want to go up and be in the Top Gun League. General is more than enough for everything you want to do for survival. And if you do it this way, you'll get, you know, you don't have to go out and spend days studying. You can do the ham cram. And this is, you know, the groups are doing this. And here's a really good thing for you, Angel. They roll out the red carpet for the ladies.
Do they really? How come?
They really do. I mean, you go to ham meetings, most of the women that are there are with their husbands because they just want to see what the husband is doing.
Yeah.
And you get a, but you get a few ladies that we call it the bite. You get a genuine interest in the technology. And if you have that, oh, they're going to treat you like a princess. They're going to help you get your license. They're going to help you get set up with your first radio. It's there's a term in ham radio called Elmer. And an Elmer is really just a mentor. And you'll have plenty of volunteers. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be a woman to find an Elmer. I found Elmers. These, you know, these are people that just have a passion and a love, and they want to help other people get into it. There's a tremendous amount of resources out there. Get the license, and then once you have the license, then you're going to decide what your first radio is that you want to get into. Usually I recommend like a mobile, something that would go into the car, because that'll give you some good range, as opposed to the little handheld walkie-talkies, or handy-talkies, as we call them as amateurs. And that'll get you going. You'll have a lot of fun doing it. A lot of fun doing it.
Let's go to Richard in Lima, Ohio. Hey, Richard, go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen. My ham call is N8IJ. I've been a ham licensed since 1951. I've taught amateur radio, including Morse code, since 1953 when I got my general class license, and I still do all of that, and I'm also an Elmer and also a volunteer examiner, so I'm pretty well-versed on what's going on here. And, Mr. Masters, thank you very much for this treatise that you're giving to us. Long past hams. I have one thing to add, just one thing.
Sure.
I see amateur radio as being the only way in the aftertime to pull together a census of family and bring families together that are scattered around the world across the country. And the Red Cross has a program to help us do that with a computer input, where they will have the ability to find these people that we're looking for by name. We hams will provide the communications between these locations that you're talking about, these survival communities. But what's going to turn out, what's going to be the outcome of all this, is that we will actually be the reason and the ability for a new census in the aftertime to find out who's still alive.
That's what it's all about, Marshall. Thank you for that, Richard. They're going to be there. They're going to be the saviors, aren't they, Master?
Absolutely.
Mark?
And Richard, thank you, sir. You inspire me. That, especially with as few letters as in your call sign, that makes me envious. But, yes, I mean, everything he said, he's right on the money, absolutely on the money.
The late Art Bell was a ham operator. He loved it.
Yes.
He was on it all the time. Had antennas at his place and everything. Kevin in Indianapolis, welcome to the show. Hi, Kev.
Hey, George, how's it going, buddy?
Okay, thank you.
Hey, I was a truck driver from Indianapolis. I listen to you guys all the time.
Oh, thank you.
I was kind of wondering about Dr. Sky, who seems to be an expert on everything out there in orbit. I was kind of trying to figure out why he never talks about this Planet X, why he don't never see it, you know?
I'll bring it up to him next time he's on.
Yeah, that'd be cool, because it seems like if this guy can see it, this guy that seems to be an expert could see it too, you know. I mean, everything is all rosy when he calls. This don't sound rosy to me.
Marshall, some people can't find it. Other people know it's there. They don't want to talk about it. How come?
Well, it's denial is a very powerful human emotion. I mean, people, when you talk about anything from the sky hurting us here on the ground, this
this is primal. This is primal. And people will have a negative reaction to it. They don't want to see it. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to hear about it. What we have right now are people that are seeing it. And right now I have one gentleman who his wife didn't believe him at all. And then they were flying, and she took the picture while they were about 10 or 12,000 feet, and she caught an image of it. Now she's a believer because she's seen it with her own two eyes. So what we have is a situation that's slowly, very slowly coming to a simmer. And there will be a point at which we see it. Now, at that point, you're going to, what you're going to hear on the television with the media is going to be, well, it's going to pass over our heads, so it's not really a problem. It's just an interesting light show. Now, the fact is, it will pass over our heads. But it is going to be something that will be a problem, particularly once it crosses Earth's orbit. And we're going to have a lot of trouble with that. But this is going to unfold slowly. So we could be, by the time you're looking at the kill shot scenario that Ed Dames is talking about, could be 2022.
Well, it's coming up.
Yeah.
It's coming up.
Yeah, it's just hard to say. You know, it's coming in, and I just can't swing the price of my own personal satellite.
No. That would be nice. Joe in Monterey, California. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. This is an interesting show. For a number of years ago, I had George has heard me on the show. I called him a number of times. He has an idea of who I am and stuff and what I can do. I usually talk to people who are very psychic, and we talk to non-dimensional people, non-physical people. And
right.
The information on Planet X is that
right.
It's inhabited, and if it comes by, and it will, as we already know now, it will probably go through the asteroid belt. And if it does, it's going to pick up what they call space debris, which is a lot of meteors.
And fling them our way.
Well, it's going to go by, and it's going to be dragging it.
Go ahead, Marshall.
Well, we're tracking fireballs. And fireballs, the volume of fireballs that are being reported now is at an all-time high. So what this gentleman's talking about is you've got this mini constellation. It's coming through the core of our system like the cue ball from hell. And it's just going to be knocking stuff, you know, with a bow wave, if you will, that's going to be throwing things in our direction. And we're going to see more and more of that as it goes on. This is one of the reasons why people are need to build their shelters underground with I recommend 10 to 12 feet of dirt because
this
is going to give you protection from EMP, but also from meteor showers.
All right, Marshall, we're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Marshall Masters, talking with us about Planet X and his book, Radio Free Earth. Where do you get the book, Marshall?
It's on Amazon. And there's three different editions. There's one that's black and white, and then there's two that are premium all-color editions. And all three are up on Amazon.
Super. Let's go back to the phones. Joe in Long Island. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah. Hi, Marshall. Happy end times.
Yeah.
A couple of questions. You went back and forth to Russia, and I'm wondering what you've gleaned lately from that, especially with regards to their space program and what they're trying to do recently with their space program. And then also, in terms of doomsday movies, one I enjoyed was The Road, which seemed to imply neutron bombs were used to where trucks were just stopped on the road, and I thought it was kind of gave you almost a roadside view of what the effects of a neutron bomb might be. And I understand, if you could say a little bit more about those bombs, I understand they're possibly used in anti-ballistic missiles, But even if a nuclear warhead is intercepted, it still detonates, from what I understand, to where you're still getting a full atomic blast, even if you're intercepting the nuclear warhead.
What would that create an EMP, Marshall?
Well, any nuclear device is going to create an EMP. Now, there are nuclear devices that are specifically designed for high altitude detonation to put out a maximum amount of EMP. That is, remember, we talked about 1 second after. And that is the scenario in that book, which is a very credible scenario.
Oh, absolutely.
You have, absolutely. And it's two EMP medium ballistic missiles are launched, I think, by a combination of like Iran and North Korea. These two warheads detonate over the U.S. and wipe out the entire grid, everything. They fry the electronics. Everything goes down. A neutron bomb is different type of bomb. These were these came up during the Jimmy Carter administration.
Mm-hmm. They don't destroy buildings, right?
Pardon?
It doesn't destroy a building, does it?
Correct. As long as it's detonated at high altitude, what happens is that the radiation only lasts for 3 days. So you detonate it over a city so that you don't destroy the city. It will kill everybody in the city. 3 days later, you can walk in and plant the flag.
With all these dead bodies all over the place.
Yeah. Cheerful. You know. So neutron bombs are... the neutron bombs that we had developed at the time were disassembled. I mean, it was just too deadly a weapon, But I'm more concerned with what's in the book, 1 second after, which is designing EMP devices. You can have an EMP device that is not nuclear, by the way. So they could put an EMP weapon into a Cessna 172 and fly it over Washington and cook everything in Washington.
And all they have to do is put it right up there. You're absolutely right. Marshall, thanks for being on the program. We really appreciate it. You are one super guy, my friend, and we think the world of you. Marshall Masters' website linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. Here's something to wrap things up for the night, of course, by popular demand, Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart.
The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous, I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly, I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none, passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture. A pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad? Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern. All closed, closed, that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly. Very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening, so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ah, Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work. For it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber, and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone, and inquiring how he has passed the night. So you see he would have been a very profound old man, indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on, steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew this sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it was welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with all these suppositions, but he had found all in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with a perfect distinctness, all a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray, as if by instinct, precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eve. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder. I say louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone, stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there for many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His Eve would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out. No stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I had been too wary for that. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart. For what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such as a sound a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God! No, no, they heard, they suspected, they knew, they were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder! 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 Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart.
Well, there you go. I'm going to have Tom say goodnight because I'm a frog tonight.
And here we go. And for Nathan Staten, Dan Galante, myself, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, be safe, everybody.